We'll do it live!
You are listening to the AMC Report with your host, Brian Dawson.
Well, the corporate mass media's coverage on Gaza, Syria, Iraq, and Ukraine has been abysmal, deceptive, self-contradicting, and hypocritical. I want to focus on Ukraine today, but a brief background on the history of repeated lies is in order because they should have zero credibility at this point. On Iraq, everything from babies on incubators to weapons of mass destruction was a lie. In Syria, they tried saying Iraq's mythical WMDs were moved there. And three times they tried to say that there were chemical weapons, the first two being busted as false flags, and the third time, I guess, was the charm. Meanwhile, Al-Qaeda groups, including ISIS, were trained and armed and financed by the West. And in Israel, the coverage is so bad that the corporate media can't even acknowledge that there is an occupation existing and claim that all the dead children are human shields, and which is the new newspeak term for collateral damage. So why in the world should we trust them on Ukraine, in particular the MH17 incident? And joining me today to walk through the corporate media's state propaganda on the downing of the commercial airliner is another independent journalist, Peter Lavelle. You may have seen him. He is the host of Crosstalk on RT, Russia Today. And he's been interviewed by numerous news outlets when they let him talk. I'm going to let him talk today. Peter, sorry for the long introduction, but welcome to Anti-Neocons.
I'm very happy to be with you. Yeah, I couldn't add one word to your introduction there. I absolutely agree with you. And that's why more and more people are listening to people like ourselves, because the lies and the hypocrisy is so obvious. It's an insult to intelligence. And we both know that the corporate media has dumbed people down so badly, but still there's this glimmer of hope that, you know, well, white isn't black and black isn't white and the moon isn't made out of cheese. So we're making some progress.
The moon's not made out of cheese. Don't say that on Fox now. Now, you were on, I can't remember if it was CNN or MSNBC.
CNN.
CNN. And the guy just wouldn't let you speak. He was just trying to blame everything on Russia. And you seemed to be saying, well, can we wait for some forensic evidence? Do you have any? And when he didn't really have a good retort, he just resorted to personal attacks, which is rather childish. But I would like you to have a chance to say what you were trying to say without him interrupting you about the downing of the airliner. What's your take on it? If you have a stance, maybe we need more evidence, but what do you feel is should be said about that?
Well, you know, if we can go back to the CNN interview with Chris Cuomo, first of all, he's not a journalist. I guess he's there because of his family name.
I was avoiding saying his name on purpose,
let's say the obvious. I mean, he's certainly not a professional journalist. I mean, maybe he's a debutante drama queen, if anything.
Oh, he's at least as qualified as Biden's son.
Okay. Yeah, big money talks, okay. One of the things that what I was trying to get across in that interview, and if, I want your listeners to know, I was fully aware that it was an ambush. I knew it wasn't going to be a pleasant experience, but I felt it was incumbent upon me to have that tiny little space that they allowed, because he thought he was going to trounce me, which of course was the reverse. But what I wanted to get across here is that there is a completely different narrative at play in Ukraine, and it is a narrative that best matches the reality on the ground. This is an artificial crisis that was made, generated, coming out of the halls of power in Brussels and in Washington. If we think about exactly 1 year ago, what was wrong with Ukraine? Well, it didn't have the most efficient economy, but it had some growth. Was it run by oligarchs? Yes. There was all this artificial coup that was made in February. Who came to power? Oh, my goodness, another oligarch. And this is a Western oligarch, a friendly to the U.S. and to Brussels.
With neo-Nazi underlings.
So what has really changed? And see, what I was trying to, convey to the CNN audience, that short moment I had, is that this is a completely different narrative at play here. Now, let's go to the shooting down of the Malaysian aircraft. Almost no one in the mainstream asks the simplest questions. You know, like motive, means, and opportunity. These are, you know, very basic skills. You know, when you look at a crime scene, mm-hmm. you look at those three elements right there. Wow. It makes perfect sense to me that you should be looking at the Ukrainian military, which, oh my goodness, has shot down commercial airliners in the past. And why would the anti-Kiev resistance in the East shoot down or want to shoot down or attempt to shoot down a plane going into Russia? That doesn't make any sense to me at all. Obviously, in my mind, we don't have all of the forensic evidence, and we might not have it for a while, unfortunately. The big debate about the black boxes is that, yes, indeed, it does take time. It can take up to 2 months to get the data from those black boxes. The fact that they're sitting in London doesn't give me a comfort zone. Nonetheless, voice recordings from the pilots, staff on the plane, and the tower back in Kiev could easily be released. They should have been released by now. That is the first part of the data that you can get off those black boxes. Where's the evidence? No one is releasing it. The United States had military naval craft in the Black Sea and in the Baltic Sea. You can't tell me after the U.S. spends over hundreds of billions of dollars on surveillance worldwide, you weren't watching the radar over Ukraine where a raging civil war is going on. It's hard to stomach, you know. The Russians, on the other hand, within, if I'm not mistaken, within a week, produced all of the data that they had of radars and other surveillance, and they didn't even point a finger. I think that's really important to realize here. They didn't say who did it. They're just saying, hey, this is what we've got. Now, take a look at it. Maybe we should have others that were looking at the same airspace at the same time, and let's compare. Let's compare and see what we can understand. The Russians have not pointed a finger at anyone. Why? Because they would like to have more evidence. Now, we, of course, you know, within hours of the downing of the plane, Putin killed my son. Okay, it's a done deal. It's, you know, it was already a trial, a kangaroo court, and all of a sudden it's blamed on Russia. Russia has
that was a newspaper headline. I know what you're referring to, but I'm pointing out for others. That was actually in a New York newspaper. Why'd you kill my son, Putin?
Yeah.
Already convicted. You know, Putin shot the plane down with lasers from his eyes. It was just without any evidence. And we've seen this in Syria. We saw it in Iraq. We're seeing it in Iraq again right now, where they go and say, well, we have mountains of evidence. Well, Kerry said he had mountains of evidence. He said, we know.
Yeah. He said that about sarin gas, too, in Syria. Remember?
We 35 times.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, over and over and over again. There was never any evidence. And quietly, oh, well, maybe we didn't have the right guy. Okay, maybe we were mistaken. But that's buried in the last paragraph of the last story on the last page. But the thing is here is that this is a very dangerous situation because, again, Western media does not portray the reality on the ground in Ukraine. Now, you and I both know that there is a legal international border separating the country known as Ukraine and Russia. Yes, it does exist. But for the people living on the ground, that border means very little to them. They move back and forth, back and forth. It's a very porous border as well. There's never been any reason to militarize it because, well, these are just the same people visiting their families, going to work. People in eastern Ukraine go to Russia to work, and vice versa. And, you know, in when Western media says, well, Putin has to shut down this border and make sure that no one passes, no arms, no materiel. Well, I seem to remember that when the Soviets were in Afghanistan and when the Americans were in Afghanistan, they never were able to stop the flow of material and people coming from Pakistan into Afghanistan. The most powerful military forces in the world could not control that border. And this is the same situation we have right now. Chris Cuomo, I'm going to watch my language here.
That's fine on my show. You say what you want.
Russians in East Ukraine. Yes, Chris, that's the problem, isn't it? You don't realize it. This is a legacy of the Habsburg Empire. Okay, Chris, did you read any history before you got on air? This is a patchwork. This is the result of Khrushchev. This is a result of Stalin and Lenin. They were the great cartographers of the 20th century. They moved borders around like whims. when the Soviet Union came to an end, again, Western media does not acknowledge this. There are millions and millions of ethnic Russians on the wrong side of the border. And this is a very difficult foreign policy issue for Russia. Again, you hear these phrases, Russia's aggressive behavior, Russia wants to rebuild the Soviet Union, Russia wants to rebuild the Russian Empire. Nothing further could be from the truth. Russia has no interest, and I mean zero interest, in ruling over anyone that it doesn't want to be ruled over by the Kremlin. But there's the problem. We have ethnic Russians on the other side of the border. Let's go back to 2008. When Saakashvili attacked civilians and internationally recognized peacekeepers in South Ossetia, Russia reacted. A lot of the people in South Ossetia are ethnic Russians and Russian passport holders. They went in for a right to protect that population, civilian population. Did they go to Tbilisi? No, they didn't. Could they have gone to Tbilisi? They could have gone there in a matter of hours, but they didn't. They have no interest in that whatsoever. This is Washington probing. It's looking for a way to undermine Russia. And what it wants to do is to control the post-Soviet space and then take on Russia itself and break it up. That's their aim. They will fail.
Yeah, you see them surrounding Russia with bases. You see NATO expanding, and yet they're accusing Russia of being aggressive and expanding. But it's the U.S. that's actually invading countries left and right. That was another thing Kerry said about Crimea, when they voted legally and had a referendum to rejoin Russia, as they had been with in the past. Kerry said it was just ruthless for them to be occupied and invaded. Meanwhile, the U.S. has an actual occupation and invasion of Afghanistan and supports the actual occupation and invasion of Palestine.
Okay, Ryan, when you talk to other guests about Crimea, I have a good question for you to ask your future guests, and it's the following question. Okay. Russia invaded Crimea. Can you tell me the date? What day did Russia invade Crimea? And you know what? No one is going to be able to answer that question, because it never was. If you go back, again, this is a common knowledge if you make any kind of effort whatsoever. When the Soviet Union came to an end, the sovereign state of Ukraine and the sovereign state of Russia signed an agreement, a lease agreement, on bases in the Crimea Peninsula. It was updated in 2009 and again in 2011. 25,000 troops were allowed on that peninsula under international agreement. So when CNN says there was an invasion, well, they'd been there since 1991 legally. Now, let's go to the coup on February 22nd. The constitutional order of Ukraine collapsed. When Russia wants to move troops around, outside of its bases in Crimea at that time, it should have made a phone call to Kiev to talk to the proper authorities. There was no one there to pick up the phone. There was no legitimate authority. All bets are off. And I think in hindsight, looking at what's happened in Lugansk and Donetsk and the Donbass, I think it was a very good idea that Crimea was protected from this savage regime in Kiev being supported by the United States. When they say that Russia should control any kind of arms going into eastern Ukraine, why is the CIA, why is the Pentagon already there openly supplying arms? You have tanks being moved from, as we speak, being moved from Hungary into Ukraine right now. That's not reported in Western media at all. So when we go back to Crimea, I'm willing to say, because I'm trying to be a person of reason, there's wiggle room there. There's gray area there. But there was a coup, and the constitutional order of Ukraine collapsed. And still, the government that rules in Kiev is illegal. The government there was what we have in government posts represent about 30% of the former parliament that was elected. 30%. Of that 30% are some of the most vicious neo-Nazi figures, and holding an ideology that you and I probably thought was buried in the 1940s. But it's back, and it's being backed by the United States and the European Union. They are backing a regime that, if you read their manifestos, they are in English, they are in the internet. They are proud of what they believe. They're proud of their racism, their Russophobia, their homophobia. They're proud of their intolerance. And no one in the Western media wants to do it. They don't have the courage because no one wants to stand up to that intellectual giant, Jen Psaki.
Well, I have another question, too. We don't have the black box's information yet. We may not ever get it since they're sitting in London. But there, besides the forensic evidence, we have some other evidence, too. And one of the things that happened in the early stages that the Western media jumped right on was some information from social media, as lowbrow as that is. But I found it interesting that when there was a story saying they had intercepted some calls or something, and it ended up being a day before the plane was actually shot down, yet it still made it on the airwaves and it wasn't really corrected very clearly. How can they make a mistake that huge? Is it really incompetence or is it intentional?
You ask a very interesting question because I grapple with this all of the time. I mean, how can a country of such vast resources and military might and intelligence capabilities, and they rely upon Twitter? This is really astounding, isn't it? I think that they're just stumbling their way through. See, what was supposed to happen? This is the coup in February was supposed to capture all of Ukraine whole and bloodlessly. Okay, maybe the sniper thing, okay, which again, there's mountains of evidence that the regime that rules there right now, or the snipers were working for them, okay?
Very similar to Syria.
Right.
When the generals got shot, yeah.
So what happened was that when the coup didn't fulfill itself the way Victoria Nuland planned, and we know that conversation, it's very explicit what she wanted to have happen, and you know what? It did happen. So in that sense, it seems that was very well planned out. But after that point, it falls apart. Their narrative is collapsing because they really don't know what to do. Ray McGovern, is very often on antiwar.com, and I've had the privilege to have him on my program.
He's a former CIA analyst.
He said something that was really interesting to me on my program. And he said, you know, Washington wins both ways, because if it didn't get all of Ukraine, then it just trashes Ukraine and makes Russia pick up the pieces, and they have the entire echo chamber in the West blames Russia for it. And so, and, you know, people like Victoria Nuland, they're cynical to the bone because, okay, we didn't get Crimea. And I'll tell you, ExxonMobil is furious about that because they were supposed to get the deep water reserves in the Black Sea. Well, with Crimea gone, Ukraine has no access to deep water in the Black Sea. So it goes to Russia. That's worth trillions and trillions of dollars, estimated anyway. But so they didn't get Crimea, the real jewel. So what do they do? Let's wreck the place. Let's really make the Russians pay heavily for allowing Crimea democratically, by the way, self-determination to return to Russia where it should have been all along. So to answer your question, I really feel that the entire foreign policy team of this president, and I'm not going Republican, Democrat, because that's a false choice there. I don't care who's in the White House, because American foreign policy is genetically coded now. It's really the neocons. You can have liberal interventionist neocon. You can play with all the words you want, but it's the same thing. It's hegemony, it's dominance, and it doesn't tolerate any resistance whatsoever.
Well, Victoria Nuland's husband is Captain Neocon himself, Robert Kagan of PNAC.
You betcha. You betcha. But I mean, if you read this stuff, what he writes, I feel intellectually insulted. But you know, the American media has dumbed people down so badly that people read it and just say, "Oh, well, you know, he's an authoritative figure." But they would never let me debate him in a public forum. No way.
Robert Kagan blamed 9/11 on Iraq.
Right. I guess you're right. The moon is made out of cheese. This is the big challenge that faces both of us in dealing with media. And we have to keep going away at it, because I'm not going to walk away from the truth. And I would love to take on Chris Cuomo again, but he won't do it because they don't want to think. They just take the 10 talking points from the State Department, and it's a done deal.
It looked like he had a little earpiece saying, help me, help me.
Well, you know what happened is my people on my team, they watched it and they told me that they thought that CNN's agenda would be to make me get angry, beat my chest and throw off my microphone and, you know, huff away. But it was the reverse. He really wanted to end that interview because I was just getting warmed up.
Yeah, I'm surprised they aired it at all. I guess it was live. I don't know.
No. You have to see what they did later. Every once in a while, I don't Google my name all that often. I have too many other things to do. But he just said, well, see, this is how effective Russian propaganda is. See, you know.
You're part of Russian propaganda.
Oh, yeah. I carry the water. That's what I'm told. I carry the water. The thing is that...
That's a common tactic, you know. Agree with us or you side with the terrorists. If you oppose the Iraq war, you're pro-Saddam. If you oppose the war in Syria, you're pro-Assad. And it's not like that. It's not one or the other like that. That's so childish and stupid. It's so asinine.
But what was really... It's really saddening to me is the collapse of the left in dealing with foreign policy. They've been so cowed by corporate media. I mean, I look at people like Stephen Cohen. I mean, this man is a hero. He is a real hero. He is alone in the U.S. going on television and pleading a case of rationality. He believes sometimes you have to become a heretic to get your voice out there. And this is what's happened. You know, they're demonizing him. You know, Stephen Cohen is about a man of almost 80 years old. And the courage that he has to stand up to everyone. And I was privileged to have him on my program with John Mearsheimer, which is one of the great foreign policy international relations theorists in the world today. He's completely shunned by the mainstream because he said Iraq is wrong. They went back to 2003. He's been silenced ever since 2003 in mainstream media because he has the wrong opinion. It has nothing to do about freedom of speech.
It reminds me of Helen Thomas. She passed away, but she was also, I think she was in her 80s too and sticking it to the man, and they took her rewards away from her.
Yep. The thing is that this is what's really scary right now. I mean, people that want to demonize me, that's fine. I have a very thick skin. But it tells me that you don't watch my program. You don't see that I have a real diversity of views. On my program, I very often have people from the Heritage Foundation. You know, people will find that odd when they find out about it. My Heritage Foundation comes on. I give them their piece. I always say, I'm not fair. I'm not free and I'm not fair. But I get everybody equal amount of time. And that's my philosophy in dealing with a public debate. I may not agree with you, but I'm going to give you your shot at it, okay? And that's why people come on the program.
It's easier for us because we're not lying. So we're welcoming debate because all we have to do is tell the truth. They don't want to debate because they look bad.
Like NATO expansion. You know, I get this question. You know, about countries want to join NATO because they fear Russian aggression. And I said, see, this gets down to a chicken and egg because you know Russia. You know, it was promised. Gorbachev was promised that it would not move one inch east if Germany could be reunified. It was reunified. And then Bill Clinton just totally walked away from that promise. It was a gentleman's agreement. Gorbachev made a huge mistake by not getting it in writing, though it probably wouldn't have mattered because the U.S. doesn't follow its obligations under international law.
American Indian treaty and you'll know how much the U.S. keeps its word.
Yeah, well, you know, you get Condoleezza Rice, you know, where there's no weapons of mass destruction. And she said, well, it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. What kind of foreign policy is that? What kind of morality is that? Well, we just destroyed not only one country, but an entire region. It's inflamed right now. Christians living in historic Middle East, they are a endangered species. Isn't that quite remarkable from George W., the evangelical Christian? What is his legacy? One of those legacies that's hardly mentioned in Western media is the destruction of the Christian communities all through the Middle East. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and they have so much attention on these, a couple hundred civilians that died in the downing of the commercial airliner, which was shot down. You see thousands of civilians killed in Gaza, and you see hundreds sometimes every day in Iraq, Syria, Libya, people being murdered, and they don't mention those deaths. But it is important, this airliner, because the reaction to it has been to talk about and implement sanctions. And I want your two cents on the sanctions and what the reaction may be from Gazprom and the Russians if sanctions go through.
It's very interesting. I also do a radio program on Voice of Russia. We did this topic yesterday, and it is on their website now. It's interesting is that I think from an energy point of view, Brussels just can't afford to let this crazy regime, this lunatic regime in Kiev, allow Europe to freeze in the winter. We're going to have a big problem with that as the months pass. And I've lived in Russia for 17 years, and it gets really cold here, and Europe needs that gas. But I think, you know, in a broader way, I actually welcome the sanctions. I really do, because Russia gets to reach out to its true partners in the world, the BRICS countries, Latin America, China. They're all stepping up and saying, we'll fill the void for meat, we'll fill the void for fish, we'll fill the void for fruit and vegetables. This is good. It will be more expensive for the Russian consumer because the transportation costs will be higher. But nonetheless, it gives Russia more flexibility. And this is what Russia is all about. It wants to exercise its foreign policy as a sovereign state, not a state kowtowing to Washington. And if you don't kowtow to Washington, look out, because there's a punishment there. But Russia is not a weak country. It's not a small country. See, the Americans, ever since the Second World War, look at the wars they pursue. They always go after weak countries that cannot protect themselves. You know, we have all of these mythologies in American history, you know, about our great wars, but they're all really shameful wars, going after countries that cannot defend themselves and killing countless.
Now, wait a minute. Grenada was clearly a threat to national security.
USA. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
You made it Grenada.
Let's go back to the sanctions. The thing is that what it does is that, again, what Western media doesn't understand is that Vladimir Putin is a very popular figure. He has his detractors, particularly in Moscow. There is a fifth column, Western liberal-like, I call them limousine liberals, okay? They just want Russia to be like the European Union. And I just say, well, if you want to be Russia to be like the European Union, why don't you move there? Because no one's stopping you. Vladimir Putin has a lot of support, and his support has only grown through this crisis. I mean, what people don't understand in the West is that for Victoria Nuland and Joe Biden and his son, by the way, you know, Ukraine is this kind of geopolitical gambit. It's, you know, it's part of this full spectrum domination of the world. You know, it's very kind of intellectual, ideological. But here, where I'm sitting in Moscow, Ukraine's a local issue. It's local. I look out my window right now. I see trees. I see buildings. I see all kinds of artifacts. But I look at the footage coming out of eastern Ukraine. You know what? It looks exactly what it looks like outside my window. That's close to home. You know, it's the same trees. It's the same bushes. It's the same Slavic faces. And, you know, Western media will never portray it that way because they don't want to put a human face on that kind of suffering. So, you know, to go back to the sanctions, yes, there is a little bit of pain, but not that much. And I'll tell you one thing. If history tells us anything, Russians know how to tighten their belt. They know how to do it. And it's the only thing that brings these people together. Russia is always kind of a borderline chaotic place.
I'm thinking of the pain on the other side. If they don't get gas, the pain on the other side is going to be bad if they don't get gas in the winter, because they really don't have, unless they lift sanctions on Iran, which is unlikely because Israel doesn't want it, they really don't have anybody to replace that gas.
Yeah, and that's why. And that's why I try to stay optimistic. We had an attempt at a peaceful resolution of what was probably not then a civil war in Ukraine back in April in Geneva. I mean, the plan was there. Everybody signed off on it. And then Poroshenko got a telephone call and said, you know, not Poroshenko, the government, Yats, as he's referred to, don't do it. Don't go through with it. And so that's been delayed. Thousands of people have been killed. We have this tragedy with this airliner. We have over a half a million people, refugees, moving in to Russia from eastern Ukraine, which is never reported by Western media. It is turning into a humanitarian crisis. But you're right. When it gets down to energy, I'm really hoping that cooler heads will prevail, because is Europe going to freeze over this? I mean, the Americans never get touched by this. Like I said, it's just kind of an academic exercise for them. They need an enemy, and NATO needs a reason to exist. That's why this is perfect for the U.S., because NATO's relevance is just so hard to pin down, and they look for these wars, these conflicts, to give it, galvanize it. In Libya, less than half the countries in NATO participated in the assault and destruction of that poor country. And what are the results now? We know it's catastrophic. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, the new enemy,
that's gone too. It's, you know, out of sight, out of mind. Oh, Libya! Oh, yeah. Don't talk about Libya.
No, because, you know, we brought democracy there, so that they'll take care of it from there. You know, I mean, it's just turning into one huge terrorist training camp. It's just, again, you know, the law of unintended consequences. I sometimes think that's what I should have named my program, because that's all I ever talk about, these unintended consequences.
It's chain of blowback. And again, from Libya, you saw the mercenaries, Tuareg, pouring into Mali, and then the French getting involved there, and that's starting to spread and further south into Africa. And they just don't connect the dots, because I don't know if it's unintended or just not even that. They don't even care.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm not a person that usually quotes Henry Kissinger. However, I do like one thing he said. He was asked about, what is neoconservatism? What does a neocon mean to you? And he said, exporting chaos. And I think he's right. You know, that there is something to that. The thing is that, you know, if you think about it in a very, very cruel way.
Isn't that also the nickname for John McCain's travel plans?
Is that a question?
Exporting chaos. John McCain's traveling around. He's chaos. Well, what I'm referring to is he went to Syria. He went to Ukraine. He went to wherever he shows up and takes a photo op with terrorists. Soon there's a coup.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, when you think about how these countries are destroyed, you identify them as an enemy. Usually they're a friend before. Look at Saddam. He was our great friend as he was pursuing his torturous war against Iran. Iran didn't start that one. It was Iraq. And then, you know, they turn into an enemy. You destroy the country. And then you have the American taxpayer pay billions and billions and billions of dollars ad infinitum for generations to come to rebuild it. You know, what we go in, destroy it, and then make the American taxpayer pay for it. You know, I'm sure the people in Detroit are really appreciative of what we're trying to do for Baghdad.
Well, exactly. And the saddest thing is, even though the corporate welfare happens and they get paid to rebuild it, much of the rebuilding never actually gets done.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It was 2 years ago, two summers ago, I went to Kabul to interview one of the greatest crooks in history, Karzai. And I was in heavy security. I will never go there again. It was really awful. It was really scary. And we were going through the city in our convoy, because you have to travel in convoys because the security situation is so bad. And I noticed, I kept looking at the buildings in the city, and I was with my Russian colleagues, and I said, this is all Soviet built, all of it. It's all Soviet built, except for a huge embassy that's being built for the Americans and a huge mosque in the center of Kabul. But the rest of it was just Soviet infrastructure. The Americans have built nothing there, nothing of substantial, except for maybe some people told me there was a great condo complex in the suburbs. I don't know. I guess it was surrounded by a huge Chinese wall. But
well, they built some prisons.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, I mean, I come from California. You know, my Californian voters are always given that choice, schools or prisons, and they go for prisons all the time.
Sadly. Yeah, what the, of course, what was it, 5,000 escaped from prison, and the prison break in instead of out? They broke in and then out of the prison in Afghanistan. Such great security, I'm sure. We're getting everything for our dime.
Well, the thing is that when you look at what's going on in the Middle East right now and what's going on in Ukraine, I can't think of a time that has been really worse, because, you know, you have these horrific regimes like Saudi Arabia that keep fueling this. You know, one of the things that in covering the Arab Spring all the way to the present is that, you know, these Sunni lunatics that are funded by the Gulf countries So you can train them, you can give them money, you can export them, but you never can control them in the end. And, you know, this is what we get with ISIS and all these other things. It's just, it's our great ally in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia. And then you look at Israel, you know, when people always say, you know, I hate that line, but Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East. And I always reply, America had no enemies in the Middle East until Israel came along. OK, and I'm not denying the right of Israel to stay as a state to exist. And it exists under international law.
But it also breaks numerous international laws.
Thank you very much. That was how I was going to follow it up. But since it does exist under international law, it is obliged to follow international law, which it rarely, rarely does. And again, it's because of Washington. Washington could have had a two-state solution done, a few phone calls, but it doesn't have the guts to do it. It doesn't have the guts. It doesn't have the courage. I mean, I living abroad most of my life, I feel so ashamed being American when it comes to the Palestine issue, because people ask me, just why does your country do this? You're the only country in the world that goes to the wall for these people. And this is just a colonialist, imperialist project in the Middle East, and it's supported by the American taxpayer. Why? I just have to say, Washington.
It's manifest destiny, and they're the only country since World War II. To attack
Capitol
the US.
Hill is Israeli-occupied territory, and it's a fault of the United States. The tragedy of the Palestinian people falls squarely on the American government, full stop.
That's Pat Buchanan said that. He said Congress is Israeli-occupied, and it's ironic because Israel's the only country since World War II to actually physically attack the United States with the USS Liberty, and yet they're the primo ally. They get $3 billion outright in forgiven loans every year. They just got another $225 million in the middle of a crisis, and the U.S. Senate voted 100-0 to give them the money when the entire world was absolutely appalled at all the child murdering and ethnic cleansing. The United States says, F you, and sends them more money. It is embarrassing, and it is hard to explain. I'm also a foreigner who lives abroad, and I have to deal with that, and I try to represent America a little better and say, well, we're not all psychotic or ignorant, but that they have a very strong lobby and they are openly allowed to bribe the plutocrats that run the world. So that's how it is.
Yeah, and you have Martin Indyk. He was the last special representative to the quote-unquote peace process. Here's a person that was accused of actually passing American secrets onto the Israelis, and it's all brushed under the carpet. And then he's the special envoy, the worst possible person to put into that position. And then he leaves the position a few months ago and said the only person that he thought was a partner was the foreign minister of Israel, Lieberman, an openly anti-Arab bigot. And Martin Indyk said that was the only person that he thought could speak reason. This is just insanity.
He's more racist than Netanyahu, Lieberman.
Yes.
Saying Palestinians give birth to snakes and things like that. He's not the only one to say that either. I mean, they actually refer to it as mowing the lawn when they cyclically go in and murder thousands of people. And how can anybody pretend to have a peace process while they're simultaneously colonizing their neighbors? If they're killing people in residential houses and bulldozing them down in the West Bank, why would anybody assume they grew a conscience in Gaza and say, oh, that's all collateral damage?
Yeah, and they like to say that, you know, Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran, said that he wants to wipe Israel off the face of the earth, which is a bad translation. He never said it. He said Israel is a country whose history should have never been written. A lot less threatening, I would say. But, you know, what country is being wiped off the map as we speak now? Palestine. Mm-hmm.
They're not only saying it, they're actively doing it. But the hypocrisy, the shamelessness is shocking. The shamelessness, because it's really easy to see the level of hypocrisy, and they know it's going to come out, and it just doesn't matter. They just said, this is my story, and I'm sticking to it, and that's U.S. foreign policy, and it's disgusting. And it's maybe you should have a show called Blowback and just...
but the thing is that, you know, when I read the Western media and the real Russophobes, you know, like we need regime change in Russia. It's really we like the Russian people, but we don't like the Russian government. I've heard that so many times before. But I'll tell you something that's so important that's happening right now is that ethnic Russians are being murdered. Civilians are being killed in eastern Ukraine who have relatives in Russia. How do you think Russians in this country, where I am right now in this city, feel about the United States when their relatives are being killed by rockets? You know, Yanukovych, they criticized him for having his riot police rough up people. And now there's a regime that's using missiles and using mines and using fighter aircraft. Yanukovych never did that, and I'm not a big fan of Mr. Yanukovych, but he never used that kind of violence. That violence is being used against people, ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine, and that is unforgivable in this country.
That may have led to the shootdown, too.
And what people feel about the United States and Americans, you know, I'm a pretty well-known quantity where I am right now, so I don't get that kind of angst. But, you know, people do it, and Russians ask me all the time, doesn't your country have value human life at all? And I said, as long as you don't see dead American bodies, no, they don't care.
Yeah, a lot of them don't care. I don't know, I don't have a good answer to that. I know, of course, people do care, but when you're talking about government, no. But I'm not a fan of any government anywhere, but there definitely is bad and there's worse. And the United States is still an imperial empire. They never stopped. The Cold War wasn't really a Cold War because millions of people died during it, especially in Southeast Asia. 3 million people, now over 1 million in Iraq, and these are all Holocausts. But they're never painted with the same brush as other evil empires like the Nazis, who also killed millions of people. You'll never get that for the United States, a country that started with genocide. But the people, I think, a lot of them are apathetic. They've given up because they can't all have shows like you and I do. They think, what can I do? Vote between, you know, two jerks? Like, they just are becoming really disconnected from everything because they feel very powerless. The police are killing people in American cities every day. They have the largest prison population. There's massive debt. And so when they're talking about problems in Ukraine or Gaza, most Americans are like, look, I need to pay my rent. You know, that's their problem.
Yeah. You know, I had a gentleman from the University of Brown University. His name is Vladimir Goldstein. And he is a Russian Jew that emigrated to the United States in the 1970s. And he's been writing quite a bit about what's going on in Ukraine and in Russia. And he took a trip here last month. And he arrived in St. Petersburg, but he wrote on Facebook, and I thought it was just so memorable. And you have to remember, he's a professor of literature, so he's a great writer. And he said, you know, going to St. Petersburg, there was a lot of Russians, obviously, on the plane, and some Americans. And he said, you know, the Russians on the plane, they asked a lot of questions of the staff, you know, like, why can't I have tea instead of coffee? Why don't you have fish? Is there any free alcohol? Or there should be some free alcohol. Can I have an extra beer? And he said, you know, the Russians were inquisitive, not always very, very polite, but, you know, they were demanding. He said, but the Americans, they were obedient. And I thought that was such an interesting comparison, because he said the Americans on the plane would just do what they were told. And that's what it's kind of like what you were saying, you know, this apathy. And you know what? If you do get out of line, you're right. Our level of incarceration is extraordinary. It's really something about the society. All they do is tell you to eat, buy things you don't need, and spend money you don't have. I don't want to live in a place like that.
Well, yeah, it's unfortunate, but that kind of consumerism, hyper-consumerism, and a very brutal police state and authoritarianism is very rampant in the United States. It's pervasive in the culture, and I know people are unhappy with it, but it's not like everyone can just move. But I think something that's really key has been the monopoly on the media. All the parent companies for mass media link right back up to the Pentagon. I've mapped that all out before. But the internet is really breaking this down. I mean, I've been covering Gaza for 17 years, and for the first 10 or so, I mean, it would be hard to explain to somebody that Palestine existed and where it was. But now, after the internet, I mean, just even comparing to a couple years ago in 2012 with Pillar of God, or in 2009, it's really changed. And it's not like the behavior's changed. Israel's killing around the same number of people, and they've always bombed hospitals and schools and all that. But it's all coming out now.
Yeah, but you know, what's really hard is how do you come? I'm in complete agreement with you. But what does an average person do when they're exposed to this and they realize they've been lied to all their life about this topic or many topics or all topics, what do you do? That puts you in a kind of paralysis, I think, because I do talk to people about, let's say, Russia or Ukraine. And when I speak to them, you know, in a calm tone and give them facts, you can see that they feel, I look in their eyes and it's like, oh my God, you're right. That makes more sense to me, what you're saying. I said, yeah, it makes more sense. But it's hard for people to change, because if you've been told, you know, like Israel is just protecting itself, you know, Israel is under siege. That's what John Kerry said. It's under siege. I mean, that, you know, it blows your mind. I mean, people like ourselves. But, you know, going back to your point about the internet, which I think is really important, I was so proud a few months ago when John Kerry called RT the bullhorns of propaganda. I mean, it was like, hey, we arrived. We are here. We've made a breakthrough. Because they're afraid of us. They're really afraid of us. And they go after us. You know, we're under a microscope in the UK and in the US. The regulators look at our material very, very, very closely. They file complaints against us. They really want to get us off air. They really do.
I've been on Israeli TV just for YouTube videos I made. Yeah, they go after you. They're scared to death of somebody breaking the monopoly on media, because I know it's hard to change someone's mind, but once someone is exposed to the truth, they never go back. There's no reversal. There's no return. And I really think the internet is paving the way for RT and shows like RT and other independent shows to just simply tell it like it is, and, you know, the facts will speak for themselves and they make more sense, as you said. And so I think that's going to be the way out. And one thing people can do who feel powerless is that you always have the power of the purse. You can always refuse to buy certain products and things. And I know that can be collectivizing, but in the long run, it does work to boycott. But divestment, of course, is a much stronger avenue to partake in, but it's something that people have to get educated about.
I've had this discussion with Norman Finkelstein, and I consider Norman a very good friend, and we disagree on this. I do support the boycott of Israeli goods. But he believes that the ultimate end is to end the state of Israel, which I don't agree with. I don't want to see states destroyed. I want to see a consensus. There's going to be a one-state solution. It's already there. It's staring you in the face. It's just how long until the Israelis recognize it. Or it's just going to dissolve all by itself. You know, when I look at what's happening inside of Israel, which is really scary when you look at the rhetoric, it's kind of like, you know, the Soviet Union never could have been defeated militarily. But the Soviet Union collapsed under its own weight with a ridiculous ideology, and Russia is free of that completely. But it was its own internal contradictions. And I think that's what's going to happen with Israel, because you cannot call yourself a Jewish state. You can't call yourself a democratic state. You can't call yourself a tolerant state and have these kind of political parties that just vie to go further and further to the right. I mean, it's not a long-term tenable reality. And I think that's what's happening. It's going to be Israel collapsing itself. It's not going to be outside forces.
Yeah, it seems to be the path they're on to self-destruction. I just hope they don't whip out the Samson option as they're going down.
That's the real fear, okay? Because talk to an intelligent Israeli, after everything they have done for so many generations, so many decades against people in their neighborhood and in their own front and backyard, the Palestinian people themselves, they have to be pretty afraid, because who's going to forgive them for what they have done? Who's going to forgive them for the massacres that they've committed? Who's going to forgive them for keeping determining the number of calories the average Gazan can have every single day? You know this. Our listeners should know that this is all documented. This is part of the public information that the Israelis have done this. And make sure that you don't starve them to death. You just keep them at that one level where they're just where you can't bring up a healthy family, where you can't have sanitation, you can't have education. This is all planned. And, you know, when push comes to shove, who's going to apologize? Who's going to forgive them for that? I'd be hard pressed.
I don't think it's going to happen. Do you have a little time to talk about ISIS in Iraq?
Sure. Go ahead. Sure.
All right. Yeah. I just have a couple questions. We're like 48 minutes in, so I was trying to cram this in here. You know, it's odd to me because they started as the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was a reaction to the invasion of Iraq, illegal invasion based on deceptions. And then when they moved into Syria, they got financed and trained by Western powers. And then, of course, they crossed that magic line again, and suddenly they're being bombed. So they get bombed, and then they get given money and guns, and now bombed again. What's going on?
The law of unintended consequences again. Look, Western American foreign policy is just so fanatical at times. It's all about Assad. And that's what it gets down to. They are willing, Washington is willing to destroy the entire region because they want one man to go. Well, if one man goes, I don't see Syria is going to completely collapse, okay? It's not about one man at all. But what it is that they haven't taken their eye off the ball. They still want to see regime change in Damascus, and then we'll take care of things later. That's what's being played out right here. ISIS, I don't know. I've talked to and interviewed and read so many experts about it. There seems to be a really a wide array of opinions about what ISIS is really all about and can it actually create a viable state. In my sense, it's probably not the case. It's because of the regime in Baghdad. You know, look at it. You know, Maliki, you know, he's our son of a bitch and all that nonsense there.
Well, he's out. He's agreed to.
He's out. Yeah. But, you know, he's out, but not down. Let's put it that way.
He's a lame duck right now, yeah.
He has significant resources, and they're not in Iraq. They're in Iran. Again, another great coup of American foreign policy. You know, you invade Iraq, you break it up into three countries. You know, Baghdad is aligned with Iran, and the Kurds are running free. And then you have these ISIS Sunni lunatics in the other part of the country. What a great game plan. And this is, again, what it is that there is no plan on how to deal with all of this. I think that they're still looking to take out Assad, and then they're going to try to figure out what to do next.
Well, that game plan of dividing into those three sectarian sections was actually laid out by an Israeli planner named Oded Yinnan in the 80s.
And the thing is that, again, it gets down to what the Gulf countries want, you know, with American Western values and this medieval regime in Saudi Arabia. You know, it's the Saudis and the other Gulf countries that are fueling this. They're the ones that are really pumping in the money, possibly the training, but certainly the financing of it all.
So why not tell them to cut it out instead of bombing, which has never really worked in the past? Why not some diplomacy? Because, you know, just bombing more people, it just causes more chaos in the long run. Why couldn't the U.S. just tell Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Kuwait, stop giving money to all these terrorists, and then we will too?
You know, the interesting thing is that, you know, Barack Obama didn't even have the guts to ask the king of Saudi Arabia, can you stop persecuting Christians? Can you tell these groups to stop beheading them and destroying their churches and burning their Bibles? Can you stop doing that? You know, that's not too much to ask. You know, and if he can't do that, then how can he ask Saudi Arabia to act it like in a civilized manner? Now, the relationship with Saudi Arabia is getting more and more complex and actually more and more dangerous because Saudis are suspicious of the Americans because they see the Americans as being weak, indecisive. The Americans are like a hammer. All they do is one big hammer. All they see is nails. And that doesn't solve. It doesn't solve problems. It creates problems. So we have a very, very odd mixture of Riyadh, Tel Aviv, and Washington. And they're not on the same page. They work in contradictory ways. And this is the result of it. I mean, if Saudi Arabia turned off the money, the Gulf countries turned off the money, we would have a very different situation on the ground. But they don't see it that way. And this is one of the problems with Western foreign policy, is that when you look at people in Riyadh, they see it. They don't see it through borders. They don't see it through history. They see it through sectarian eyes. And this is something that's very dangerous for Washington, because I can remember, Bernstein, when he wrote about Bush and going into the war in 2003, and someone was explaining, a general was explaining to Bush, he said, well, up here we have these Kurds, and down the south we have Sunni, and over here we have Shia. And Bush apparently said, well, I thought they were all Muslims, okay? And that's what it kind of gets down to, because we don't see it that way. And when we do, this is what makes these people motivate them. And then you have incursion. What was it called? The surge, which is a complete lie. It was complete fiction, and they keep spinning it over and over again. It was a complete lie that had already been ethnic cleansing. And then the Americans say, hey, look, we've solved the problem. They have separated because we did it. No, it's because of our incursion and the breakup of the state. That's why it happened here. So I don't think the West understands very well, or if it does, it's doing it in a very cynical way because it can't control outcomes. See, this is the problem, particularly since the end of the Cold War, where Washington doesn't understand it can't win wars. And with all of its military might, it can't win wars. And it can't determine political outcomes.
See, I'm more cynical than that. I don't think they're really aiming at winning. I think the whole point and purpose of war is for profiteering. And I think that's what Saudi Arabia is. They're a conduit to sell a bunch of F-35s and things, too, for the military-industrial complex. And chaos is profit. They could care less who dies or what they win.
But you could also, and I think this is what the Bush people thought with Iraq. I think they truly believed it. You know, people say it's all about oil. You know, my friend, I wish it were just all about oil, because then it would make sense. But it's not about that. And for these Bush people and for Victoria Nuland's, it's more they're ideologically driven. They really believe in their own nonsense. Mm-hmm. I think they truly believed that they could turn Iraq into a Western democracy, and that would be a seed in the desert, and it would bloom, and it would be a way to take out Iran, take out Syria, Hezbollah. I think they really believed it. As fanciful and fantasy-like as that is, I think they truly believed it. And then you get into the law of unintended consequences. It's not going to work. But you could get all of the profiteering that you mentioned there. You still get it. You still sell planes. You still put people in debt when they don't need to be in debt. You tie them into the dollar economy. You strangle them. Okay, and that's what they want. They always do. But I still think that they had this kind of idealistic. They really truly believed that they were doing the right thing. And I think if you look at Condoleezza Rice, she still says this dribble, because I think she actually believes it.
That's one way. I mean, they are that naive. You have Bush was born again, but I think Cheney knew. I know he knew, because in 1994 he said the reason they didn't finish him off in the first Gulf War is because it would create a quagmire, and he laid out exactly what would happen. So you know he knew what was going to happen, and they still did it anyway.
Yeah.
It certainly wasn't for oil, because all of the deceptive lies that led to the war in Iraq came from the PNAC cabal. They were all from these Israelis. That's who connected it to 9/11. That's who gave us the BS about anthrax. That's who gave us the BS about mobile weapons labs. And all of it came from the Weekly Standard and those guys, not from Exxon, not from the oil companies. It came from the Israelis. Iraq was a threat to Israeli hegemony, not the United States. But
yeah,
the United States bows to Israel.
It's interesting. It was Iraq is the, you know, Saddam is the new Hitler. Okay. I mean, how many new Hitlers do you need? Okay.
Oh, and Putin was a new Hitler, wasn't he?
That's what they said. The Israelis said, Saddam, he's the new Hitler. We have to take him out. You know, and there's always, it was Nasser or before, or Arafat, you know, there's always Hitler
Gaddafi.
In the Middle East for Israel.
Gaddafi was one. And you know who wrote that? There's actually a piece called, Bombing Iraq by Robert Kagan, and it says it compares him to Hitler 14 times in like three pages. But the ironic thing in Ukraine is they're comparing Putin to Hitler while the West is actually financing actual Nazis.
This is really the irony of it all. You know, when people they said this is like a new Munich. You know, they love to throw that one around. You know, this is a new Munich. This is appeasement and all that. But you know, if you go back and look at the destruction of Czechoslovakia in 1938, it was Western powers that did that. They signed an agreement with Hitler. They didn't even let the Czechoslovak government in the room. They certainly didn't listen to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union said, no, you can't trust these people, okay? Don't do it. But it was the West that sold Czechoslovakia down the river in 1938. And you know what? It was the European Union with the connivance of the United States in February of this year that sold the sovereign state of Ukraine down the river. They broke that country, not Vladimir Putin, not Russia. No, it doesn't make any logical sense why Russia would want to have a conflict on its border. Why? Crimea, it had a treaty with them.
But Peter, you're using logic and reason and silly stuff like that.
Yep, that's right. That's right. And that's really what it makes it very painful to have our jobs. Because when you say this to people and you put it out in a very clear, coherent, logical manner, you can get traction. But that's verboten. Don't ever say that. Because on CNN or BBC, oh, you know, that's why I'm proud of my program, is that I have very intelligent people, well-respected people, good scholars, good writers, good journalists, but they're not allowed in the mainstream. They're not allowed on television. And that's why I have my guests, because like Robert Fisk, mm-hmm. How often is he on CNN? They don't want him on there because he'll say something different, a different narrative. That's why he's always welcomed on Crosstalk.
Well, you see, the intellectuals get punished, Ward Churchill, Norman Finkelstein, etc., for having the views they do. You can lose your job. You can lose everything just for your political beliefs in the United States. And in Europe, you can go to jail sometimes.
It's really extraordinary. I won't name the person I have in mind, but at the Carnegie here in Moscow, a very well-known, respected scholar in the late 1990s, he was saying, Yeltsin is not really much of a Democrat, and Yeltsin, he's lost control of the country because of these oligarchs, and then Putin came in, and he was writing, well, Putin is taking care of the oligarchs. It's really necessary to do that, and protecting the country's sovereignty, not bound down to the U.S. on everything, and he was hounded out of the Carnegie here because he didn't keep the narrative. And he had a tough, tough time. At one point in time, I'll reveal the name, but he's doing all right now. But he was severely, and this is a personal story that I know, he was severely punished for having his opinions. And they really were not extreme. They were just different, a different way of looking at the world.
Well, you look at Ron Paul, the way they tried to call him a racist and everything else, just because he was saying the philosophy of non-intervention, you know. This is an old doctor, old man, and they smeared him left and right.
During the Iowa caucus, remember who came in first place and who came in third place? They talked about who came in first place, who came in third place. He actually won it in the end. But, you know, I remember watching the coverage. They wouldn't even mention his name. It was who came in third and who came in first. And then when they finally counted all the votes, he actually won the caucus. But who remembers that now? Almost no one. Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, Ron Paul is a real hero for me. And Pat Buchanan, too. I mean, I never would have thought that I would be a fan of Pat Buchanan. When I was growing up, I was this, snooty liberal I'd hold my nose when Pat Buchanan spoke, okay? But with his foreign policy stuff, he's spot on.
His write-up on ISIS recently, I recommend it. I can't remember the title. But Pat Buchanan, ISIS, it was on antiwar.com 2 days ago. And I was like, wow, I'm agreeing with Patrick Buchanan. But yeah. He put a video I made up about Tibet on his website once. So I know he watches from time to time, which is cool. But I think, shows like yours, that they need to become the new media. I mean, the mass media has a lot of money, but, it costs a lot less to tell the truth than it does to lie. And so I think people just should be supporting these alternative medias, independent journalists more. And it's not going to happen overnight, but slowly we are going to bring about a lot of changes. I mean, we focus on a lot of bad things, and there are a lot of bad things in the world, but majority of Earth is anti-war. Things are a lot better than they were in the past. It's just we know about the bad things more now. It's kind of like the news on hurricanes. The more you cover them, the worse they seem. But things are slowly getting better. And so we have to focus on supporting the internet and independent journalists and people who are in the mass media really sticking their neck out.
It's really interesting in our conversation here. I haven't heard you stumble and search for words and try to give me doublespeak, and I haven't done the same to you. Like you said, if you say the truth, it's pretty easy to say it and get it out straight.
Yeah, it's just really clear. I mean, it's not that hard to tell the truth. People ask me how I can do hours of shows on all these different topics. And I say, well, I just Yeah, I research, of course, and I read about them, and then I just tell the truth. And if I don't know something, I say, I don't know. What do you think?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming on, and I look forward to watching Crosstalk more in the future, and I recommend everybody to check out your program. It is an independent program. It is not Russian propaganda.
Thank you very much.
Carrying the water for the Putin. and the guy you wouldn't mention, he was spot on, you know, because Yegor Gaidar sold the whole country down the river to the oligarchs, Boris Berezovsky and the rest of them, and Yeltsin was an alcoholic worse than Biden. Well, I don't know, maybe. and he has a problem. But yeah, he was right, and you don't have to say his name, but you see individuals like that, you'll get a George Galloway or a Ron Paul or somebody speaking out against war, and everybody hounds on them, and that's disgusting, but I think that's changing, I really do.
Okay, well, I'm going to try to keep your optimism, my friend.
Yeah, it's not optimism, it's realism.
Okay.
Because everybody thinks what they think is realistic, otherwise they wouldn't think it out, right? So, but yeah. Well, I look forward to your program in the future, as I said, and thank you for coming on today.
Okay, thank you for having me on. Okay, all right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.